Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tapped into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. Today, we're going to be talking to a professor of history and the Canadian Research Chair at the University of Saskatchewan, Erica Dyke. And so, Erica, how are you doing right now? And would you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me on the show. My name is Erica Dick. I'm at the University of Saskatchewan, a history professor here, and I have the pleasure of studying the history of health and medicine, social justice, and a lot of my work intersects with psychedelics.
So out of curiosity, you know, it's unique to find people who specialize specifically in things like the history of psychedelics and LSD. How did you sort of find your way into this sort of interesting subject? It is fairly obscure, right?
Yeah, you know, these days it's getting less and less obscure. But when I started my research in the early 2000s, certainly, you know, lots of people sort of made fun of my research project and didn't think it was very serious history. And certainly there were no jobs as a historian of psychedelics. And so my work really started off as a Canadian history project and trying to understand how Canadian players had participated in a series of healthcare reforms that started in Saskatchewan, you know, how psychedelics came to fit into a serious set of reforms that Canadians now recognize as Medicare. And yet, you know, I was really curious about how these particular drug experiments could fit into something so mainstream or seemingly so status quo like Medicare.
So fundamentally, like, you know, most people, when you think of psychedelic history, specifically with LSD, you think of Hoffman and, you know, all of these sort of legendary figures of psychedelics and LSD. But, you know, previous to actually reading into you and listening to your podcast, I'd never really heard very much of Canadian sort of history regarding psychedelics. And it's one of those unspoken things. And I find that Canadians, we like other people's culture and like other people's history. We don't really know much about ourselves, let alone this specific subject matter. So could you sort of enlighten us a little bit on this topic?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that, you know, the study of psychedelics often sounds a bit exotic or a bit out there or something that has to come from somewhere else. And yet the word psychedelic is a Canadian invention, if you will. Granted, the folks who came up with it were British-born folks, but psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond was working in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, what is now a growing community there near an oil patch, but was a very small rural community in southeastern Saskatchewan. And he was the superintendent of a major psychiatric hospital there, so sort of off the beaten path in many respects. And it was through his relationship with Aldous Huxley, of course, another British-born author then living in California and already quite famous for his work, things like Brave New World, for example. And it's their relationship that gave rise to the word psychedelic. And they met in 1953. Humphrey Osmond gave Aldous Huxley his first mescaline experience, which he drove to Los Angeles from Weyburn, Saskatchewan to deliver mescaline. And so this relationship that continued for the next 10 years until Aldous Huxley's death really nourished this research and curiosity about psychedelics that unfolded on the Canadian prairies in a way that I think maybe Canadians are sometimes, you know, sort of shy to talk about or didn't even realize happened, particularly in a kind of small farming community in the prairies.
Well, in Saskatchewan too, like that psychiatric facility was one of the larger in Canada, no? And it housed a significant amount of people. It was very advanced at its time. And they were doing a lot of really powerful work and dealing with schizophrenia as well as alcoholism and cessation and so forth. Can you provide us some information on what they were specifically doing there?
Yeah. So Humphrey Osmond came to the Weyburn Psychiatric Facility. It was called the Saskatchewan Provincial Mental Hospital, or SASC Hospital. It's got a variety of different names, the mental, as some people unaffectionately referred to it. He came there in 1951 as part of the healthcare reforms that were ushered in by Tommy Douglas, then the premier and also acting as health minister of the province. So he's, you know, in Canadian terms, the father of Medicare, if you will, and he's, you know, considered CBC's greatest Canadian, particularly for these quite significant healthcare reforms that then spread across the country. And this British-trained psychiatrist was one player in this whole host of other reforms that were taking place. And Osmond came to Saskatchewan in the fall of 1951 on the premise that he was going to become the superintendent of this large, sort of Gothic-styled old style asylum, a place that had by then already become sort of notorious for warehousing people. A lot of people had been segregated from their communities. They'd been cut off from their families. And some people describe this as sort of the dust bins of psychiatry, where people were warehoused for unwanted symptoms. Osmond set out to reform this place. And one of the things he was particularly curious about was investing in, before we have the word psychedelic, psychoactive substances like LSD, mescaline, and later psilocybin. Those were the three he primarily used to try to understand what it was like to live with major mental illnesses. So initially they thought if you took psychedelics, if you took LSD, you could imagine or you could experience something that was like schizophrenia for a temporary period, but something that would allow you to empathize with those patients who were otherwise sort of warehoused in these big old asylums. And this was a really exciting intervention because prior to this, people with schizophrenia with psychotic disorders were really difficult to communicate with, really difficult to reach or understand or empathize with. And so the first arm of the research was really about working with staff, psychiatric nurses, social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, a number of students, probably some cabinet ministers we have on rumored authority, participated in these as a way of sort of understanding the world of madness. And it's done in a really, I think it sort of surprises people sometimes to think that this wasn't initially used as a treatment. It wasn't like most of psychiatric history where you discover something and then apply it to patients. Here it was applying to staff. And I think that's a kind of an interesting reform idea.
Well, it's fantastic too. There was a tool of empathy in a sense to try and anecdotally experience what their patients are experiencing so that they can actually treat them better. And it's also wise to know that at this time, psychiatry was alarming in a lot of places in the world. Electroshock therapy, lobotomies weren't far in the history. And this is general idea of this is a containment system. We're not trying to help people. We're trying to contain them. And then having this capacity for people to want to empathetically understand the ailment that their patients have is actually really profound. And now it wasn't just, Humphrey Osmond is doing this well. He had other people that were working with him. Can you enlighten us on those people as well, please?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about Saskatchewan that, anyone in Canada who's tried to get through Saskatchewan might realize is, there's these little clusters of communities and, you'd necessarily have to get to know your neighbors if you're living in these small places. And one of the things about living in Weyburn at this giant hospital on the Bald Prairie was that there was a kind of ingrained interdisciplinarity or, a way of interprofessional or multiprofessional associations, we might say today. So alongside Humphrey Osmond, he had psychologist Duncan Blewett, who was in Regina. He had Abe Hoffer, who was a serial chemist and psychiatrist working in Saskatoon, and a whole variety of other people and their wives. And I want to emphasize this because I think sometimes the women who were not paid for these jobs, they weren't named on papers. Their names are not associated with this history, but they were very fundamental to the thinking and the research and some of the creativity that went into these experiments in the 1950s. I'll give one quick example. Psychologist Robert Summer traveled from Kansas to Weyburn. The thing about Weyburn was that it had become a bit of an ideological magnet at this point. So people with progressive ideas saw this as a good space to invest their energy, but also intersecting with psychedelics. Psychedelics plus socialism meant that it attracted a number of people from a variety of different places that we might not otherwise think would land in Saskatchewan. But some of them had also these incredible wives with other skills, like music therapy. Robert Summer's wife, Dorothy, was a music therapist, and she brought music into the psychedelic setting. And now we might think, well, obviously, you have to have music on your psychedelic journey. And it seems so obvious and apparent. But sometimes it was these sort of other influences. And sometimes we might see this as a bit of a recreational diversion, but some of the early experiments were done at house parties or dinner parties. Probably in tweed jackets and, 1950s garb. It's not a Grateful Dead concert yet. But nonetheless, there were a variety of influences that I think really helped to nourish these projects that unfolded on the prairies.
That sounds kind of interesting. It seems to be sort of the evolution of the notion of set and setting seemed to sort of emerge at this point. And I feel like a lot of the times too, previous to this, is that everything was very analytical. Everything was very cut and dry and lacking sort of the sort of this subjective human experience of having a psychedelic experience. And let's be realistic too, like having a very significant experience in LSD is deeply personal, deeply vulnerable. There's a lot of things that you're confronting inside that place, having that experience. And, you know, to me, the idea of doing a large dose of psychedelics with a bunch of people standing around me with bright lights and other people in the room and hospital curtains seems rather terrifying, to be honest with you. So it's interesting. Yeah, right? And like how this place in Saskatchewan at that time was so far ahead of everyone else.
They readily recognize the concepts that we now say are set and setting, or that later other people coined as that. By 1952, they were writing up, you know, very crude kind of manuals or protocols for how to best optimize the experience. And by optimize, I don't mean, you know, have a pleasant one necessarily, or confront God or confront your mother, or, you know, there weren't sort of specific scenarios that they were trying to create, not yet, but certainly to have a safe experience. They thought about how do you prepare for that? How do you set up the room? You know, you have to have a comfortable couch, for example. You want to have private access to a washroom. You want to bring some features of nature into the room. Fresh cut flowers were one of the ways they did this. Photographs, visual stimuli, artwork, and music. And they spent some time thinking about the kinds of playlists. Now, again, these were not Jimi Hendrix inspired playlists. They were very much classical music, but even sort of working with some jazz musicians and some classically trained therapists, music therapists, that is, they started to think about how you actually calibrate a sonic expression that would, you know, choreograph your psychedelic journey.
Well, and it's funny too, like in ayahuasca ceremonies, I participated in those quite a few times. And, you know, the music is to some degree orchestrating your experience. And I feel like, you know, historically speaking, from an anthropological perspective, when people were doing, you know, these indigenous people were doing these, you know, these healing ceremonies, and for whatever reason, spiritual healing or so forth, there was a lot more involved. There was ritualism, there's symbology, there was, like you said, music and sort of these things orchestrating and allowing this to proceed. And then we get into sort of a Western medicine perspective of looking at psychedelics objectively and just as a medicine that affects your body, and then totally eliminating sort of this, like, you know, empathetic human sort of associate with what's going on. And it's actually took a great deal of insight from my perspective for these people to actually sit back and look at this and be like, how do we make this a better experience? How do we not look at this as just simply a drug and look at it as a human experience that people are undergoing? And I find that quite incredible.
I think some of their motivation or inspiration for doing this was not about psychedelics per se. But that psychedelics were a tool for getting at different ways of thinking about consciousness, for theorizing empathy, for thinking about pathological conditions or gaining insight into those conditions. And some later on in Humphrey Osmond's life, he was sort of reflecting on, he wasn't so bold as to say his legacy. He seemed actually quite humble given how much he'd written and how much he'd accomplished, but he really appreciated what he had done for patients who reached out to him to say how much it meant for him to see them. And I mean that in that he saw them as people first and patients second, or people first and people seeking help second. And that really meant a lot to him that he had done something in this space to promote an empathetic encounter with psychiatrists, or the psy disciplines, if you will. And, you know, I think that's really important to bear in mind that he did coin the word psychedelic, and psychedelics were very much associated with Humphrey Osmond, but he really felt that this was a tool for thinking about challenging some of those notions of Western medicine, or some of those reductionist qualities that were sort of ingrained in Western medicine. And I want to just mention that he took inspiration from some indigenous ceremonies as well. And again, this, if we look at it from our 21st century perspective eyes, you know, this is a guy with a British accent and a tweed suit in most of the images that we see. He does not look like, he looks like a colonist, you know, or a colonizer. He fits that frame of this white dude. But, you know, he sat in peyote ceremonies and he participated in thinking about these kind of rituals and tried to both defend those ceremonies when the Canadian government was looking at changing the Indian Act and was arguing that these peyote ceremonies were imported into Canada and therefore they were, you know, offside and they should be stamped out. Osmond came to their defense. This did not put him in good position with the Canadian government. But he also felt that Western medicine had a lot to learn about the notion of ritual and confronting notions of spirituality within a medicalized space. So maybe seeing God or seeing outside of yourself or having what many people described as a spiritual reaction was actually therapeutic and had healing components invested in it. And he said, we don't have the vocabulary for thinking about that through the diagnostics and statistics manual, for example, or we don't have the vocabulary for thinking about that in the context of our psychiatric nomenclature. So in some ways, he sort of aligns with some of the anti-psychiatry movements that are coming up at the same time. And he would never identify, I don't think, as an anti-psychiatrist, but he's very much a critic of mainstream psychiatry at this time. And I think that's part of where his interest in psychedelics came from.
Well, and it's funny too, is that when you were describing sort of the method in which they were doing this, like I've participated in sweat lodges and so forth. And I remember the first time I went to one, I wasn't sure what to expect. And went inside in the darkness with these men and the vulnerability that they were expressing and sort of this idea of just being able to let this stuff out. It was actually deeply moving. And to have that sort of idea that back in the 50s, these academics were actually regressing back and sort of not renouncing necessarily the ideas of modern psychiatry, but accepting the fact that maybe they weren't right. And then moving towards actually talking to indigenous leaders in the community and sort of integrating some of these thoughts and philosophies, which I might be wrong in this, but that seems relatively unheard of at that time.
You know, I think they were borrowing some of those ideas from anthropologists who were doing some of the same work. Ethnobotany was flourishing at this moment. And so I think they're taking some of these ideas from other disciplines and incorporating those back into psychiatry. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, it's not until the 1950s that we really see the beginnings of a psychopharmacological revolution and a real, I'll say, sort of paradigm shift towards thinking about the origins of big pharma. It's kind of little pharma until this point. And so in some ways, there's this clash of perspectives that, you know, maybe I don't speak in hypotheticals or I don't want to speak too much in hypotheticals, but if the psychedelics had sort of attracted a different kind of energy and a different kind of motivation, you can imagine big pharma taking a very different path. But that would, I think, require an ideological shift and, you know, the end of capitalism or I don't know, something. It's hard to imagine what it would take to derail that.
You know, and we've talked about that in previous podcasts too, the idea that psychedelics have not been necessarily pursued by big pharma because the absence of sustainability with it. Like you want to keep patients. You want to give them an SSRI every day. You want to not really fix them. You want to just have them tread water for a while. You know, and the idea of psychedelics actually having a profound effect and allowing people to process traumas doesn't really fit what you would call a modern capitalist model at all. In fact, I find it amazing that, you know, even I think the pharmaceutical companies now have sort of the writing's on the wall. And they're just trying to get ahead of it by doing these analogs and so forth. But it is funny and quite interesting is that, you know, at that time in the 50s in Saskatchewan, that you had this movement being generated and pursuing forward. And I would imagine probably it ended similar to the same way that this movement did in the States as well. You know, usually the Americans want something to happen. Everyone just does it out of, you know, knee bend, kiss the ring sort of concept. So what did happen to sort of shut this whole thing down and what happened to it afterwards?
Well, I'll back up just a tiny bit to say that, you know, I don't want to lean into conspiracy theories, but I do think that the support of I'll call it what they called it, a socialist government in Saskatchewan that was looking for healthcare reforms that were going to be publicly funded did allow for this project to move forward, perhaps more so than it might have under different circumstances. So I do think that there is that kind of ideological or political economy component that allowed it to progress as it did for about a decade. And, you know, to be cheeky and super Canadian about this, I'd say that, you know, one factor that maybe isn't considered in the American context to the same degree is winter. Many people complained about living in Saskatchewan during winter. And as it was this kind of ideological magnet, people came from other places and they got tired. Now that is not the only reason. I certainly wouldn't say that winter killed psychedelics. But you know, for a little bit of Canadian content, I think it's not the combination of a kind of frustration of not being in a cosmopolitan place with these 8 months of winter, getting stuck in snowstorms, wives threatening to leave, you know, if they didn't move to a different place for a while. I think those kinds of things created a bit of an exhaustion with the political experiment that was taking place. And if we
I'm just remarking that I find it fascinating that part of the reason why this experiment sort of fell was seasonal affective disorder. And I get that concept. Canadian winters are arduous, and Saskatchewan is no exception to that in any way, shape, or form. But that's actually an amazing observation of it.
I mean, I joke a little bit. I grew up in Saskatchewan and I've survived winters, you know, it is possible, but I do think that, you know, as psychedelics were moving forward and taking on a kind of larger than life persona, there were many other players getting involved, some of whom sort of stuck with the scientific logic, many of whom deviated from that and moved this into different contexts. I think, you know, the proverbial cat was out of the bag, and it was difficult to maintain this within a regulated healthcare framework, for one. And the sort of political enthusiasm that had brought people to Saskatchewan in the early parts of the 1950s was beginning to wane. You know, there were vicious elections, you know, based on Medicare that were narrowly won, then narrowly lost. And, you know, I think that kind of the momentum was starting to wane in this period. Osmond left in 61, Tommy Douglas left to become the federal leader. So some of those leaders also moved around, and there's a bit of a psychedelic diaspora, I think, and even a political diaspora that starts to take shape at this point. I think it was difficult to maintain credible momentum. As psychedelics became associated with a whole variety of other activities, many of which were south of our border, but not all. I mean, Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal had their own kind of versions of Haight-Ashbury, you know, Toronto's Yorkville, Kitsilano in Vancouver. And there were a number of riots. There are a number of things that I think give an opportunity to associate psychedelics and acid in particular, whether that's LSD or just a generic term that's applied to things that cause you to hallucinate or drugs in general. It gave opportunities for authority to clamp down on this. It also, I think, started to cleave the scientific community, as those who were, you know, less in support of psychedelics or even decidedly against psychedelics in psychotherapy or in psychiatry, they sort of lined up with this other political momentum to bring psychedelics into the space of, you know, dangerous drugs and non-medical or drugs with no medical use, which was what the Canadian Commission called them. And I think that made it really difficult for scientists or psychiatrists or people working in this field to maintain their credibility.
You know, I think part of it too is that, you know, psychedelics are unlike any other medication. And that if you pursue psychedelics, and you will start to develop a sense of spirituality. And it's hard not to. And I'd be challenged to find someone who hasn't done psychedelics and have developed a sense of spirituality. And I think that sense of spirituality can sometimes discredit people when they start speaking in manners that don't reflect the current idea of psychiatry. And, you know, and like you're talking about too, the ideas of like Haight-Ashbury and San Francisco, and then the anti-war movement itself. And I think part of this whole movement to sort of just, we need to stop using psychedelics, was the potential destabilization of our nation's youth. And I think that, again, that comes down to that fear mongering, and we need to stop this before things escalate, which is really unfortunate because, you know, we look at now, you know, the modern, like Imperial College and John Hopkins and Roland Griffiths and all these people and the studies that they've been doing, you know, there's like what, like a 40 year gap in between these things. And it's alarming that the amounts of positivity that was actually going on with these things was just simply halted based on an ideological divergence. And I do find it interesting that, you know, at that time, I think that psychiatry was very rigid in how they saw things, and to convince, you know, a British educated psychiatrist of the merits of these compounds, which were, you know, associated with, you know, quote unquote, heathen tradition, is amazing and a very difficult task. And then going and having this, you know, haven of understanding and empathy out in the Saskatchewan plains, it almost seems too idealistic to last. And whether that didn't last due to political, and everything's complicated, right? There's always a multitude of reasons why anything fails or doesn't. And in that circumstance, it's interesting that you just have this microcosm of something that was so deeply ahead of its time, located in an inhospitable place. And it's tragic that that didn't spread anywhere further. But at the same thing, you know, like I'm always of the impression of things just happen because they need to happen in that manner. And it is what it is. But from that perspective, like, you know, how much of modern psychedelic science that you currently see around us is based specifically on what they were doing in Saskatchewan at that time?
You know, I think it's a really interesting question. I think there's a tendency sometimes to dismiss the past or to reject what happened in the past as a way of trying to move this forward, you know, almost to reject the entire idea. Like, these guys were, you know, naive in their assumptions and things went badly and this time we're going to do it better. And so I think there's a temptation to try to distance oneself from the past and suggest that, you know, this time it's completely different. But I'm not convinced that it is. And of course, there are core principles that thread throughout this entire history, whether it like moved through the underground and then reemerges in the 21st century with the likes of the work at Imperial College and Johns Hopkins and San Francisco and et cetera. I think there are a number of things, and I'll be a historian here for a moment because that's what I am. You know, in the 1950s, there was this other contextual sort of cultural moment of the Cold War and this, you know, fear of nuclear annihilation that I think also was, whether it was on the back or the front of people's minds, it's also a contextual piece here that there was a real searching and a real frustration and like rising levels of anxiety on a cultural level. I think we have that today as well. Yeah. I think, you know, whether, well, we may argue that we're re-entering a Cold War period or a hot war period for that matter. You know, there are the Russians are at it again. But we've also got, you know, a global pandemic. We've got existential crises about climate change and environmental destruction. And there are a whole variety of things that we can point to. And we're more connected through social media than ever before. So the kind of baseline for cultural anxiety, I think, is rising again, more similar perhaps to what we might imagine was happening in the 1950s. That tension and I think cultural searching also leads to trying to think outside a box. I think that we may be experiencing, and it's hard, you know, historians like to look back so that we can have perspective. It's hard to sort of get perspective in the moment, but we may be in the midst of another sort of paradigmatic shift in how we understand trauma and suffering and what alleviates those things, whether they are in fact pills that we pay for or whether they're more, you know, grounded in something that comes from nature, something that aligns us with those principles that about, you know, sustainability, both in humans and in nature. And we may say those are inseparable. I think that kind of like existential searching or in crisis moment is helping to galvanize this psychedelic moment. Here again, I'll come back to Osmond and say, like, I'm not sure that it's psychedelics per se. Like, if we get psychedelics decriminalized, will that be the end? The world's problems will be solved? I doubt it. But I do think that investing in the ideas that are associated with psychedelics, whether one consumes them or just allows the possibility, if we free our minds enough to imagine, like, what if it's okay for someone else to take psychedelics, even if I choose not to take them? Or what if it's okay to use this in a palliative context that means we might confront spiritual components in a healthcare setting, just allowing for that as a cultural acceptance of these kinds of ideas itself, I think would be revolutionary.
Well, and so do I, because, and part of me, this is my perception, which might be wrong, is that, you know, it's allowing the notion of psychedelics is sort of bridging sort of an Eastern and Western medicine sort of component. And like in Western medicine, there's always this idea that your brain in an emotional sense is totally separate from your body and thus will be treated differently, whether, you know, that's you have cancer or broken bone or you're depressed. These are two entirely different things, and that's fine, but there's correlations constantly between my emotional state and how my body functions. And it seems that, and I completely agree with this concept, is that allowing a sense of spirituality with psychedelics seems to actually bridge a lot of principles from around the world, even like in Hinduism and the Rig Veda, Chinese medicine with the idea of qi and these different things. they become a little bit more apparent and relevant. And my thing too is like, how are we supposed to create a bridge between these two things and find a harmonious relationship between these two separate ideologies? And I find that people don't like to change. You know, people can be motivated and that's fine. But at the end of the day, people have a tendency to very much adhere to these ideological principles. And again, like we said before, psychedelics are unlike any other medication. Like it's a profound experience. And even small amounts can still elicit changes in people that are very positive. And then you can go the other direction and having like ego deaths and deep spiritual experiences. And that in itself sort of completely defies our knowledge of Western medicine and what it means to be an organism. And it forces you to confront spirituality. And I'm curious to see how that goes.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree. I think that, you know, thinking globally as we imagine the different kind of philosophies and underpinnings of a psychedelic way of thinking is really useful. And I would argue that, you know, here in Canada, we have an opportunity to even just look within our own borders for some of that, for some of those ideas. And, you know, we're in a process, I think, of reconciliation with our Indigenous cultures. And even here at home, you know, there's an opportunity to think outside of those Western frameworks and lean into this as a process of reconciliation as well, in thinking about other cosmologies, other ways of understanding our place in the universe, in relationship to nature, in relation to healing, trauma, spirituality, all sorts of things that I think Indigenous cultures, and I won't, you know, I know they're very, very different, but there are Indigenous healers here in Canada who already have other ways of understanding how these features might align. And I think we could do a lot to build some of those bridges and even think locally as we, you know, also draw in those influences from elsewhere. And I think you're absolutely right, though. I think this is a moment, it's a real opportunity, rather, to think deeply about some of the rutted thinking that we've come into, whether it's, you know, our addiction to oil and gas, or, you know, an addiction to a variety of ways of thinking, or this sort of entrenched thinking on a whole host of subjects. You know, I think thinking with psychedelics, and again, that may be consuming them, but it might also just be giving them some intellectual capital, has a lot of opportunity and a lot of potential.
Well, and I completely agree with that. And part of my perspective is I've done a considerable amount of psychedelics over my lifetime, and I can look back objectively and see the change in my perception and the increase in empathy and the increase in spirituality. And I do think on some level, like, you know, it's naive to say that psychedelics will fix the planet and whatever, but they can fix our psyche or help us fix our psyche, a more inaccurate statement. And simple, subtle shifts over large groups of people can very much change what we feel we need to have and what rights that we require. And the fact that I require two, you know, diesel trucks and I require to fly across the planet frequently for my vacations because it's a human right. I think those things might change a little bit as we progress down this path. And, you know, it's one of my observations. And again, too, like I've had a conversation with someone else about this, is that during COVID, for instance, I noticed on Netflix that there's like 7-8 different psychedelic documentaries. And, you know, and to me, and I hate to say this because it's using Netflix as sort of like this barometer for public opinion, but it very much is reflective of that. Like Netflix puts on what people want to see. Mm-hmm. And they're opportunistically taking these things, but it shows that people are now in a position to be more accepting of this. And I think it was like 80% of Canadians actually think that psilocybin to be used in medical treatment in some capacity is warranted. Like that says a lot. Like that's very significant considering, you know, 10 years ago, you know, the public perception of psychedelics was similar to the way cannabis was 10 years before that. It's this, you know, it's this substance, it's highly addictive, it's dangerous, it'll hijack your brain, it's a gateway drug, and all these other ridiculous statements. And, you know, here we are, and I do believe that we're on the cusp of a psychedelic renaissance, and like a true one this time that has enough momentum to push past stigma and to push past, you know, the few people that are really holding their ground on this. And I think it does. It confronts notions too of theology and organized religion. And there's a lot of things that are going to have to blend together. And I think it's going to be a difficult partnership, but I'm very excited to sort of see how this whole movement ends up over the course of the next 10 years.
Yeah. I think that there's a cultural exhaustion with some of the ways that we've been treating whole variety of things. And psychedelics, in my opinion, are not simply for treating things that we might see as deficits or lesser thans or whatever that might be, pathological conditions. I think psychedelics for a long time have also been used for creative purposes or for, you know, to lean into some kind of flourishing or innovation or just thinking differently, aligning with a kind of spirituality. None of those things that we would associate with requiring a prescription.
And I mean, as the Greeks call it the muses when they were in the Mysteries of Eleusis.
Sorry. Okay, let's see. Yeah, sorry. And yeah, it was emotionally a muse. And that was actually one thing I wanted to sort of segue into with this is that, you know, we're talking before about the idea that you specialize also in the history of women within psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, The Immortality Key, which is a very interesting book that I've read. And it goes into like the Greek use of psychedelics. And it shows like, you know, women were the purveyors of the sacraments, like the priestesses of Demeter were the ones that were doing this. And then subsequently after with, you know, the Inquisition, the Catholic Church was primarily trying to stamp out these women, quote unquote, witches who were actually providing psychedelics. And so it seems that before the Catholic Church got its fingers and, you know, monopolized itself, that women were actually the ones who were providing this. And then you even look at, you know, Mexican culture, like Maria Sabina, who was, you know, the priestess who was, or medicine woman who was providing, you know, like a psilocybin. And so that it seems to me that at some point in time, there was this weird diluted shift into sort of this masculine idea that we are the gatekeepers of this. And I find it sort of ridiculous in the same sense. And again, it goes back to this theological perspectives of religion and patriarchy and all these different ideas. You know, what's sort of your opinion on that concept of that? It really does seem from a historical perspective, women were the ones who were the purveyors of these medicines.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are always complicated relationships, but I do think that women have been often written out or not ever written in, I should say, to this history. And you're right. I think that coveting this kind of knowledge, sacred knowledge, sometimes knowledge that was not meant to be shared. Sometimes, you know, there were, ergot was used in birthing rituals, and now it was used for different reasons, and it wasn't necessarily to produce what we would think of today as a psychedelic experience. And nonetheless, stewards of these plant medicines were often women. And either that wasn't considered worth writing down, or it was considered forbidden to write these things down because these were sort of sacred relationships with plants that were not meant to be codified or written down. You had to earn a kind of almost like an apprenticeship model of learning this knowledge and embodying that knowledge rather than codifying it in text. So some of this, I mean, you know, as a historian works through texts, basically, we don't have those things to work with. And this is one of the reasons I think why women haven't been acknowledged in this space. But there were also a lot of really damning penalties. And I say damning because they had religious as well as legal implications, depending on your time frame and depending on where you are.
You know, it's terrifying. Like, you know, the penalties that women were facing throughout, you know, Europe and during this time period was brutally being murdered, tortured.
Absolutely.
Like, it's actually terrifying, the idea. And then these women were still continuing to do this. And, you know, when you talk about ergot too, like it was used to stop postpartum hemorrhage because of the vasoconstrictive properties. Mm-hmm. Like there was
a lot of miscarriages.
Yeah, right. As a form of contraception or, you know, dealing with circumstance.
Exactly.
Which was a punishable by death in itself. And so it's, to me, like it shows this level of bravery throughout the time in which women were openly being persecuted and not even in a way that we can relate to. And this continued for a very significant period of time.
I think it continues to this day in some respects. I think, you know, one of the things that I've been sort of chipping away at is meeting with women in particular who have been continuing to work in what we might say are kind of underground spaces and either continuing to protect plants. Some of the psychedelic plants are very slow growing, and you know, if they're harvested, it takes a long time for them to come back. So we still have women and men, but I mean, there are a number of women who continue to be stewards of these plant medicines. And some of that is through indigenous cultures and some of it is not. And also women who've been sort of safeguarding this knowledge, these ideas, sometimes literally, you know, taking care of men and kids and others who have gotten themselves into trouble more publicly And women are sort of left behind to pick up the pieces and to carry the torch in a kind of quiet way. And that, I think, is kind of scattered throughout this history. Women who continue to like take care of either the actual psychoactive materials themselves, but also the people who are affected by them. So sometimes sitting with them through bad trips, if you will. And they're often sort of observers and definitely participants, and yet often not named. And I will just say also, sometimes I think that's good. You know, just shining a light on these women's activities, I'm not sure does enough to empower them, because I think it puts them in harm's way and some risk as well. And I think we, you know, that's something that I'm learning as a historian working in this area, is that, you know, there's a reason why some of this knowledge and some of these activities have continued to participate or play out in the shadows.
Well, it's interesting too, where you weigh the pros and cons of anonymity versus being able to have this information being readily accessible. Mm-hmm. And we live in an era now too of sheer accessibility. Like, I have a supercomputer that sits in my pocket. I can Google anything at any time. And the idea of having this, you know, this secretiveness and this knowledge that is not being passed on some level, it's almost, you know, it's sad and tragic, but at the same time, like you raise a very valid point about the level of persecution that can be ensued by this. You know, and even now, like look at, I don't know, there was a recent Supreme Court ruling that is both alarming and ridiculous, like Wade versus Roe. Like, the, you know, the writing was on the wall for that, let's be realistic. But at the same time, like, have we stepped back 30, 40 years?
50.
Like, right? Like it seems it's just incredible. And you know, someone can very easily sort of scoff at the idea of, oh, they, you know, there's no threat to them. And it's like, no, there is. There is a threat to them, and having to remain anonymous to this is both alarming, but yet a sign of the times that as a culture, I don't think we're necessarily prepared for a lot of the answers to questions that we ask.
Erica, for a bit of a Canadian perspective, you mentioned some psychedelic plant medicines that you're working with Indigenous tribes. Now, are you speaking from like Canadian Indigenous tribes, or are you talking more Central and South American Indigenous tribes? And what are some of these plant medicines that you're kind of speaking of besides just mushrooms? Because I think most people think of psychedelics, they immediately go to mushrooms. I'm always asking Adam, like, some other types of psychedelics besides mushrooms. So that's essentially my question to you.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we go to the literature on this, the anthropological literature, and even some of the journalistic literature, we really see a focus or a concentration on Latin America for sure. Mexico, you know, peyote and psilocybin grow naturally there. And then we can move all through, you know, into Brazil and throughout the Amazon basin, where we see ayahuasca and a whole variety of other plant medicines that are being used. What I find from working on the periphery, working with some Indigenous communities here in Saskatchewan and in Canada, we don't have the same, you know, peyote doesn't grow naturally here. Psilocybin does grow in some parts of Canada. But these stories change again. And putting this into another cultural context, you know, revealing information about, like, oh, by the way, we have these sacred plants that grow in our territory, you know, people are quite wary of, a whole variety of people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, are quite wary of the over-harvesting or the piracy that might take place, and also the sort of commodifying that knowledge or taking that knowledge in addition to the plants and turning them against them, or, you know, putting that into a colonial framework. And so there's a real reticence to talking about this, certainly that I've encountered in Canada. And I think, you know, there's some really amazing work that's being done. Nancy Turner is an incredible ethnobotanist who's worked for a long time with linguists and Indigenous communities in the Pacific Northwest, and identified a whole bunch of plants, some of which are involved with psychoactive experiences. And sometimes the framing of that itself becomes quite Western. So if one goes through a life transition, psychoactive plants may be involved, but the point or the sort of framing of that is the life transition. Maybe it's a sweat, maybe there's a, you know, different kinds of experiences involved, but the plants are one part of a larger story. And so I think one of the challenges in digging through literature or trying to find this in Canadian terms is isolating those compounds kind of ruins the rest of the story, or it kind of undermines the entire experience. And so it requires, I think, a more expansive vocabulary and perhaps more expansive thinking to imagine where Indigenous knowledge might fit into our Canadian understanding of psychoactive plants. And that's my long-winded non-answer to your good question.
Well, no, it's totally reasonable. I know it's funny that I've actually done a Canadian psychedelic. It was a canary grass, contains DMT, and it was sort of an ayahuasca-like concoction that was, it was interesting. And you know, it's funny that, you know, with ayahuasca from the Amazon, you know, people have a tendency to see jaguars and, you know, animals from the rainforest. And on this, I was like wolves, and it was weird. And, you know, when I'm saying this, this is just my experience on this psychedelic, but it was, you know, I was having visions of North American flora and fauna, which was actually really interesting. And it was, I think it was harvested from Northern Ontario or something like that. And it's, yeah, canary sawgrass. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting anyone do this. There's a little bit more than just taking it, eating it, and, you know, consuming Syrian rue or some nonsense. But yeah, and, you know, it's funny too, that statement that you made about, in a lot of Indigenous cultures that have been utilizing these medicines for thousands of years, potentially, the way that we consume them now is not the way they're meant to be consumed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think it's a worth statement that a lot of the traditions of the Amazon rainforest is that the shaman takes the ayahuasca, and he goes in the spirit world to find answers for the client or to find some sort of healing or some variation of that. And so the way that we've viewed it now is that, no, I'm doing the ayahuasca. I'm doing this for my experience. This is my right. I'm going to change the entire way that this plant medicine has been given to people is sort of an interesting Western perspective of, this is my experience. This is my right to do this. And it's like, well, yes and no. And I guess this is just an evolution of something. But it is interesting to take note, though, is that there's a lot more to it than what we're choosing to draw from it. You know, and even like going into a sweat or doing all these different things, it's a process. And I'm not like a process of attrition by any mean, but it's arduous. There's more to it. There's a lot of ceremony, like fasting and preparation. And then now people just want, that's I think it's the same thing culturally with Western medicine, is I want a pill and I want to be fixed. I don't want to do any work associated with it. I just want to do it. And I think that conflicts with the very nature of psychedelics, is that psychedelics isn't about taking a pill.
I think you're exactly right. Yeah.
You know, out of curiosity, Erica, you know, we're kind of running out of time a little bit, but, you know, the way you speak about plant medicines and stuff, do you have any personal experience with them?
I don't have a lot of personal experience with psychedelic plant medicines. And I mean, maybe that will change in the future, but I will say that when I started doing this work in a more intense way in the early 2000s, the conversation was quite different. And I felt like there was quite a lot of heat, or, you know, there was some heat on me, and maybe I was paranoid. But, you know, I was asked this question quite a lot, and it closed doors, or it opened doors, you know, and there was this, you could feel the divide, you know, I had to change the way that I was approaching this, you know, thinking about research ethics, thinking about trying to complete my graduate work in a way that would allow me to graduate. Talking about my own personal experiences was not something that was really on the table at that time. And here, you know, again, thinking as a historian, the way that we're able to tell stories about this now has really changed. A few people opened up to me in the past. Now, lots and lots of people open up and want to talk about those personal experiences, whereas before, that kind of conversation could have gotten me into a lot of trouble. And I was even coached at the time through research ethics to, you know, what happens if someone tells me that they took an illegal substance? Do I have the duty to report on them? You know, that kind of context, which today seems maybe strange, like, of course I'm not going to, and of course I wasn't going to, but, you know, as I'm trying to thread the needle of an ethical review board, it was a really fraught set of questions. So yeah, I had to try to sort of stay in my objective frame throughout that process. And like I said, it's really interesting now as the stories change and as, I mean, you know, more people come forward and are, you know, Michael Pollan's book where he, you know, openly talks about taking his own drugs. Well, it's a bestseller, you know, now it's going to be on a Netflix documentary. That is a really different sort of canvas for telling stories about psychedelics than 10, 20, 30 years ago, when that might've got people in a lot of trouble.
Well, you become a pariah overnight by simply making the wrong comment to the wrong person. Like, the stigma was very real. And it was funny that you're like, maybe I was paranoid, maybe I wasn't. I'm like, no, you were justifiably paranoid. That's a reasonable statement. Good for you for having that, you know, self-awareness. But yeah. So Erica, I feel like we're sort of coming to the end of this. And I just want to say that I really appreciate your perspective on this. And, you know, it's amazing finding someone who's dedicated themselves to this specific subject matter and started doing so in a time when it was dangerous. You know what I mean? Like, politically, your career-wise, like, you put a lot at risk for this. And I know I appreciate the effort you put into this and for educating people. And I've read a lot of your work and it's fascinating. And I look forward to continuing to listen to you speak.
Well, thank you so much. I feel like I had lots of support and, you know, some good people around me to, you know, fan the flames of curiosity, which has helped me to go on this path. So thanks. And thanks for your interest.
Oh, Erica, before we go, I just want to ask you if you have anything you want to plug right now, any books you've written, any research papers you want to direct the audience towards, or any shout outs you want to provide to anybody.
I'm absolutely terrible for remembering to ask that. Yeah.
I've got a couple of books that came out in the last year. I could grab them off my shelf if you want, so I can make sure I get the titles correct. Bear with me. I'm on crutches, so I'm just going to hobble. Just one sec. Last year, we published a graphic novel called Wonder Drug, LSD in the Land of Living Skies, which I worked with Hugh Goldring and Nicole Burton to try to bring this story to different readers or different consumers of information, I suppose. It's mostly pictures. So it's a graphic novel version of the Canadian story of psychedelics. And I think that's kind of cool.
Listen, some of us over here on the right side of the screen really appreciate you applying pictures to our reading
novel. Graphic novels. And it actually, the artistry looks a little bit.
It's cool.
Yeah, it looks great. Like,
And then this spring, I guess, depending on where, it was in Vancouver, so I'll call it spring, anything after January is spring, right? Jesse Donaldson and I wrote The Acid Room, or it got published. And this, The Acid Room, The Psychedelic Trials and Tribulations of Hollywood Hospital. Hollywood was in Vancouver, actually. It's in New Westminster. And it was a private hospital that had a number of patients. Over 500 patients went to it, many of whom paid for psychedelic therapies at that time. And we go through those records and try to bring some of those stories to life a little bit while following some of the really wild characters who came in and out of that as staff, including people like Al Hubbard, who was like a double agent in the US and then hid out in Canada with a briefcase of psychedelics.
Interesting. That was very gonzo of him. That's carrying a briefcase full of psychedelics.
he's amazing. Incredible story. And if it's okay, I'll this one is called Mujeres y Psicodélicos, and I won't even try to say the subtitle because that's as much Spanish as I have. But as part of the Chacruna series on women in psychedelics, we're putting out two books, one in Spanish and one in English. They will be very similar, you know, other than the language translation, but it's a collection of stories, short essays and blog pieces about women in this history. And what we really tried to emphasize was the flow of information or the flow of stories from North to South America. So we really focused on drawing out some of the stories from Latin American authors and women who've been working in this space, both as sort of historical actors as well as authors. So I'm excited to see where that goes because we're trying to open up this conversation a little bit and also challenge us Anglophones to think differently or think with an open mind about how these stories about, you know, women and shaman, particularly in Latin America, have contributed to this history or how they've been written out of it sometimes.
So out of curiosity, if one of our viewers wanted to get that book, what would be the English translation they'd be looking for?
The English translation will be out, I believe, in January. That's the last date I've heard on that. I don't have like a specific date. So it's due to come out in 2023 and it's going to be called Women in Psychedelics. I think it's Uncovering Invisible Voices. And it's coming up with Synergetic Press, which is based in San Francisco. But yeah, stay tuned.
No, I'll definitely put that on my reading list. That actually sounds quite awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
Excellent. Sorry, well, thanks again, Eric.
No. Well, that was by all means. Give us your time. Please feel free to promote whatever you want. Yeah, exactly. If you have a soft drink you want to promote, do it. It's okay.
Yeah, right. right. I'm working on a new book on the global history of psychedelics, but stay tuned. That'll be a year away yet.
All right. Awesome. Take care, Erica.
All right. Thanks, Erica.
Cool. Thanks so much.